Hello, and welcome to episode 60 of Ballot to Talk About. It's Saturday the 4th of December 2021, and joining me, as always, from across the other side of the globe, is my co-host, Churn. How is everything going, Churn?
Gosh, I can't believe we are finally in, shockingly in December already. Where's the time gone? But more importantly, Sam, I can see from our introduction, we've actually kept our campaign promise to as our introduction song. So unlike some other politicians, we've done well, haven't we?
Yes, we have delivered on our expectations from last week's podcast. So, but very happy to be having a bit of Taylor Swift starting us off this week.
And the amazing thing is that Spotify Unwrapped also confirmed that Taylor Swift is one of my most listened to. So I'm glad to put a bit of my influence and my music taste into this week's podcast. Were you surprised by our Spotify Unwrapped? Your Spotify Unwrapped?
I actually don't use Spotify, so I didn't have a personal one. But we did get a Spotify Unwrapped for the podcast, which was lovely to have a little look at. And it was talking about people who listen to us from all over the world, which I don't know about you, Churn, but it was really nice to see because we just do this in our respective offices and bedrooms across on different sides of the globe, and it's lovely to think that people are listening to us from all sorts of corners of the world. Some of the countries that were on our list I was really impressed with, so please do continue to listen to us, and we hope to bring you a lot more political news and analysis as we move into 2022.
Gosh, that's going to take some getting used to. But anyway, before we reach 2022, as Spotify has wrapped up its 2021, we thought it was time to wrap up the political year in that is 2021, reflecting on the ups and downs in what has been probably an amazing and unprecedented year. And a little bit later on, we'll be reflecting on two themes that probably define the political year itself, that being COVID-19 and climate change. But first, Sam, shall we start with our political awards once again? And it's been we're going to have to nominate new people for all these categories. So let's just dive into it, shall we?
Absolutely. And these prestigious awards, you might remember, if you were with us last year, we were presenting towards the end of 2020. And we've just got a few categories that Churn and I came up with, and we've both come up with our own nominees for each of them. So the first one, Churn, that we both put down was an award called the Did That Really Happen in 2021 Award. And I'm very interested to hear about what you nominated for this one.
Yes, and I'm going to go for quite a recent event because we've done politics for a long period of time. There are not many things that can surprise us or force me in particular to read the headline to make sure it was actually true. But for me, you can't really go from now current Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson's first attempt to be nominated as Prime Minister. And I remember going to bed reading, okay, done and dusted. She narrowly ensured that the vote of no confidence against her fell short by one, which was 174 votes against her. There was 175 votes against her needed to be successful. And I went to bed thinking, well, Sweden has nominated its first historic Swedish female Prime Minister. And I when I woke up the next morning, I got a text from you, if you recall. And it went something along the lines of madness or Sweden went crazy. And I was wondering, how crazy could it get? And I then went on to BBC News and realized she had resigned. And it was one of those things, as I said, I had to read about 2-3 times to make sure that it was true. So to me, because of the fact that it was one of those moments where I don't really see a prime minister give up the ball so quickly after creating history. And the reason which she created history was not only the fact that she's first female prime minister, but also because she had to resign because her coalition collapsed. The Greens pulled out of the coalition because it refused to vote for a centre-right, a budget which was passed by the Riksdag, which is the Swedish parliament, that was supported by the far-right, and the Greens absolutely refused to take part in it. And so therefore, it caused the collapse of the coalition, and therefore she had forced to resign. And that is, to me, a frankly amazing thing that happened. I found it very amusing that if you look through Google News, it was such a fast-paced event. There's still some of the top trending news was the fact that she was appointed its first female prime minister. So that's quite a historic-making occasion. What about you, Sam? Do you agree that's a moment of 2021?
I mean, that was certainly a huge shock for both of us. And I mean, as of now, she has been re-elected as the Prime Minister of Sweden and is expected to carry her respective party into next year's general election. But given her previous premiership lasted a mere 7 hours, who knows whether she will actually make it to that election, but we'll be keeping an eye on it.
I saw a funny tweet actually before we move on was that Madeleine Anderson has created history. She has become the first person to have the far to be the first and second female prime minister of a country in the record amount of times. And I do think that it's probably a record amount of time we should create history in that regard.
Exactly. I mean, for my nomination for this award, I went down a slightly different route, which was interpreting it as, did that actually happen this year? And I just went for President Joe Biden's inauguration. Because I genuinely couldn't believe when I was looking back at things we've covered this year that at the start of 2021, Donald Trump was still president. And that to me was just, I couldn't believe that that was still less than 12 months ago because it really feels like the world, the United States, and indeed Joe Biden's presidency has moved on so much in less than 12 months that I couldn't conceive that it was still this year that the 45th president was still in office. So I don't know about you, Chern, but I really couldn't believe that that was in the same 12-month cycle.
Or frankly, at the start of the year, Benjamin Netanyahu was Prime Minister of Israel and is still not Prime Minister of Israel as you speak. I think that's something which, that an event that hasn't happened, that something is one of the most biggest surprises, in my opinion, that coalition of that breadth with the left-wing Meretz to the far-right Bennett is still very much going in Israel. In fact, I recently read it passed a budget, which is one of the key tenets of one of a big minefield of any coalition is the fact that it could potentially fall down in its ability to pass a budget. But the fact it's done so, I think definitely does merit in the fact that it caused an event that we all thought will might happen to not happen. And the fact that it didn't happen does should also be mentioned as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Chern, where are we going to turn to next in our political awards?
So if we go from did that really happen, let's go to the worst politician of the year. And there's quite an obvious choice when we reflect on this category, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the way we did this is we created a document where Chern and I would both put down our nominations for the awards. And for this one, it was the only award really in the whole series of them where we put the same answer immediately. Because I think it's very difficult to look beyond Armin Laschet for this award. Because at the start of the year, if you'd have told me that the CDU candidate for Chancellor not only didn't win the Chancellery, but also led the CDU to its worst election result in the party's history. And some of the stats that I found at the time when we were covering the election, I genuinely couldn't believe when I was rereading them this morning. The fact that the CDU didn't gain votes in any of the 299 constituencies across the country, which is just astounding considering the dominance of the CDU over the last 16 years in Germany. And I don't think Laschet is helped by the fact that he's directly compared to his predecessor Angela Merkel, who is one of the second longest serving chancellor since the Federal Republic was formed in 1949, and was a really notable chancellor in terms of the European Union as well in the 21st century, one of the most renowned leaders of the 21st century. So I don't think that helps. But nonetheless, as a candidate in his own rights, I just think his entire election campaign was just a ticking time bomb of disasters, one thing after another for Armin Laschet, and then it resulted in the CDU having, frankly, a very surprising election result, certainly compared to expectations across the summer.
I think what I find amazing is that if Armin Laschet wins this award, and I think there's a lot of merit to him winning the worst politician year, that certainly the CDU deserves merit for being the worst party of the year. Because there was a very obvious choice, if you recall, Sam, of the CSU chief, Markus Söder. And it's one of the biggest unknowns to me in German politics, is how he would have performed if he was the chance of the candidate, because we're heading into an Olaf Scholz premiership where it's very likely, you know, Germans yearn for stability. I can't remember certainly there ever being a one-term German government in my political history. So if it could mean the CDU could spend several terms in the wilderness as well. And the biggest unknown to me is whether that conundrum would have been avoided if Armin Laschet was not so forceful in his ambitions in wanting to become chancellor. That to me is the biggest unknown. I think that what I find interesting about it is that I sort of gotten used to the fact that the SPD, certainly in the last few elections, had been polling around the mid-20s. We saw that in the 2013 election, the 2017 election, and the 2021 elections. Despite improving, they were still with a 2 in front of it. I never thought I would see the CDU or expect the CDU at the start of the year to have another 2 in front of it. And that, to me, big part of the blame can be pressed onto Armin Laschet. And if you look at it as well, he also, by the end of the year, lost the minister presidency of the North Rhine-Westphalia, his own state. I mean, his chances of ever being re-elected were low, shall we say, but he once went from poised to becoming one of the most powerful person, if not the world, but certainly the European Union, to a man who has suddenly lost everything. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I also saw the name that you put down as a potential honourable mention for this category is another one who went from the start of the year being at lofty heights of high office to just this week announcing they're leaving politics altogether, isn't it, Chern?
Indeed, and actually it's in the neighbourhood of Germany, which is Sebastian Kurz, a former Austrian chancellor, has this week announced he's leaving politics altogether, actually. And I think in some ways his fall from grace was even more dramatic, actually, because at the start of the year, he was polling far ahead, even further ahead than the CDU was polling from the SPD. He was polling, you know, in the low 30s, high 30s. And he ends the year with his Austrian People's Party truly smashed, really. There's no other way of saying it. You know, the Social Democrats, which if you recall, we did our Euro 2020, it's a halfway point of Austrian politics. I certainly don't think we saw the next 6 months of that happening, to be honest, with a People's Party now in second place behind the Social Democrats. It's the first time that has happened since 2017. And he's not only no longer in the chancellery, he's no longer party leader, he's facing corruption charges, which could potentially taint the Peace People's Party in the months and years to come. So I think that is certainly one of, not up there in terms of dramatic falls from grace. And even though he did try to hold on, I think it was no longer tenable when the parliamentary immunity, which he thought he would gain, certainly was not going to ever happen given the political climate. And if I were his People's Party, given the fact that Alexander Schallenberg is going to resign as chancellor over the next couple of months and another replacement, very likely the new party leader, would likely come in, I sort of see this as a big worry for the People's Party. Thankfully for them, the next election is 2023, but they're going in with the COVID situation in Austria very much deteriorating and the social fabric of the country deteriorating. That is a big problem for it as it heads into the future. So a lot of it was caused by nonetheless politics, but also the personality of Sebastian Kurz has turned out to be its savior at one point, but now it's left a trail of destruction.
Absolutely, and I think that's a great honourable mention for that category. The next one is sort of a pair of categories to do with elections themselves. So the first one is going to be the most important or consequential election of the year, paired with the most surprising election result of the year. So let's go with the consequential one first, Chern. I'll throw mine into the ring. The first one I came up with was actually one that took place right at the start of the year, which was the Georgia Senate special elections that were held at the very beginning of January. Because I think the result of those Senate special elections was not only a bit of a surprise to political observers, but because it gave Democrats a 50-50 with the deciding vote of the vice president majority in the Senate, I think it completely altered the expectations of the Biden first term and defined this year as being one that Biden would not necessarily struggle through legislatively, even though the majority was that slim, and meant that any victory, which key political observers would say is quite an achievement considering the state of the majorities in both chambers of Congress, would actually be diminished because the headline is the Democrats have a trifecta and have struggled to do this earlier. So I think not only was it consequently leading to some huge legislative achievements that have been obtained over the past year, but it also meant that those legislative achievements, I think, were diminished because the expectations bar for the Biden first term was significantly raised when the Democrats won both of those Senate specials. So that's my offering for the most important election.
I think that's a worthy contender, to be honest. And considering the path we thought to a probable Senate majority, you know, running through Maine, North Carolina, for example, if you recall, it turned out neither of us, I think, really thought it would run through two Georgia Senate races, to be honest. So I think from my point of view, that is certainly an honorable mention. But in a way itself, right, I think the biggest expectations it allowed the Democrats as well is that you suddenly had a situation at 50-50 where you had Chuck Schumer's majority, the one of the most important Senate abilities of the Senate is to confirm members to the judiciary. And now with the filibuster lowered down to a simple majority rather than a super majority of 60 had been in the past, it will give Democrats a chance to slightly rebalance the judiciary bench in a way that Mitch McConnell was so able to do under the Donald Trump presidency over the last 4 years. And the question remaining, and as we head into the 2022 midterms, where the Democrats, based on current polling, could very well lose this majority, is whether they could replace some of their ailing liberal judges on the Supreme Court, looking at Stephen Breyer over there. And that, I think, would very much not happen, that talk of his retirement, of the Democrats trying to suggest he should retire, would not have happened if they had no control of the chamber. So I think that conversation is certainly one aspect of which that would have not come up if the Democrats didn't retake the chamber.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, what was your contribution to the most important election, in your opinion?
Well, I took a slightly different interpretation of it because I was looking at the trends of elections we had throughout the year. And to me, I'm going to nominate an election that took place over the summer, rather in July or so, which was just before we went off our summer break, which was the Moldova presidential election, where you recall Maia Sandu was narrowly elected over the incumbent president. And I think it was significant for two reasons. One, it signaled the fact that for Moldova, a country that's often sandwiched geopolitically between looking east towards Russia and looking west towards the European Union, we saw a shift geopolitically from it looking east to it looking west. The second thing I thought that it really crystallized in my mind was up to that point, the fate of incumbent governments had been one rather successful. But beyond that, we saw Maia Sandu unseating the incumbent president, we really saw a change in the tide there. You know, after the election, you could argue that if we looked at the series of elections, Justin Trudeau proved to be the exception to the rule. We saw changes to government in Norway, you know, Germany, for example. You could argue Argentina to a certain extent as well. So all these changes would not have happened if, and I think it marked the consequential turn for when the tide of incumbency, you know, the rally around the flag effect that we talked about, truly dissipated. And I think Moldova was that turning point.
I think that's a great contribution to that award. And I think it's something that is going to come up when we move on to talk about some of the themes of 2021 a bit later on as well. In terms of the most surprising election results, Chern, where did you turn for that one?
Well, to be honest, my faux pas saying it live on podcasting that Andrzej Babiš would remain prime minister and then not turn out to be was the most surprising election result. I think what also made me choose this election was the fact that it was very clear as I saw the votes coming out that Prague would be the, was where most of the votes are standing in a very urban area. And what was surprising against me, and I thought at that point, is that, well, it would benefit the Pirates then because they are more progressive center-left kind of unit, really. But the reality turned out was that Prague turned out to strengthen the center-right alliance, the SPOLU alliance, which I found really interesting. And I suppose it shows you that coming from Anglosphere kind of politics, where urban areas are very much dominated by center-left politics, that, you know, one must take a more different view as well. Like, for example, we then saw that in Argentina, where the city of Buenos Aires is very much controlled by the center-right. And that, to me, that kind of surprise would not really happen if not for the Chechnya results. And I think it does show that what we sometimes perceive as politics in the Anglosphere might not necessarily apply in some other European countries or in the Spanish-speaking world as well. And that heterogeneity or that would not have come to me if not for realizing how well the center-right performed when Prague did turn out decisively for SPOLU. So I think the two things, one was the overall result itself, but also how the urban area turns out, to me, is why it is the most surprising election result and did change how I view politics going into the future.
I mean, it's certainly surprising in that both of us got our predictions wildly wrong. I mean, it's not unusual for us to get predictions wrong on this podcast, but Czechia was particularly a problematic one. But I went down a slightly different route, which was not to do with the actual election numbers itself, but to do with the consequences of the election in terms of government formation. And for me, one of the biggest surprises, which actually only finally came in last week, was the eventual government formed after the Icelandic election. Because if you remember, Katrín Jakobsdóttir of the Left Green movement was the incumbent prime minister going into that election. And after the election, her party ended up finishing third to both of her coalition partners at the time, the Independence Party and the Progressive Party. And the expectation was that this coalition government would probably be maintained because they had quite high approval ratings, they'd managed to pass a budget, they were in a numerical position to form a government again. However, Katrín Jakobsdóttir, despite being the leader of the third largest party now in this three-party coalition, continued on as prime minister. And as the odd one out in the arrangement, because she leads the left-wing party in a coalition that's made up of a right-wing party and a centre-right-wing party, I just found that really astounding that she managed to hold on to the position of prime minister even in that context, because we both talked about how Bjarni Benediktsson, who is the leader of the now the largest party in the coalition, was eyeing up the office of prime minister. So I just find it astounding, really, that she managed to hold on to that office despite the poor performance of her party and despite the fact that the government is now overwhelmingly majority right-wing.
Well, you say that, actually. I think if I recall back to Iceland discussion, we talked about sometimes the perils of placing politicians on what we assume is a traditional centre-left and centre-right. And, you know, in Iceland, for example, that is actually more between a more protectionist versus globalist view of the world. And I think that is particularly, and I think we're very much reminded about this in the formation of this government, really. I think I share your surprise that the fact that Katrín Jakobsdóttir, as the smallest of her political parties, really got the office of prime minister again. And indeed, that she went into her first cabinet, her left green movement, had three cabinet positions in it. And this time round, in her second cabinet, there will be three left green movement cabinet ministers, including her. So the fact that they maintain that same composition despite going down in seats, I find particularly interesting as well. But I think the second thing I'd like to point out is the fact that she actually went into it. Because if you recall, you know, I thought it would send a warning that some of her left-wing voters were potentially not very happy with her and the compromises she had to make. But it clearly seems that that was not a deterrent for her in forming a government. So, very much we will continue to monitor what happens in Iceland over the next 4 years. And indeed, something we will talk about again when we come around to do our European review of some of the news stories that happened recently in next week or so. So very much more to come. But Sam, we then move on from elections to probably the last two categories and probably the most important categories. We'll first start off with Rising Star of the Year. I'm going to nominate somebody who I think at the start of the year was not really in the conscience of most people, but by the end of it, thanks to several notable speeches in particular, and a big event for her country was the Politician of the Year, which is Maya Mottley, the Prime Minister of Barbados. She gave a very strong speech critiquing, you know, the world against vaccine nationalism. And you could argue that the Omicron variant was a direct side effect of some of the warnings she gave it when she spoke to United Nations. She gave a very strong speech in favor of more climate action to be taken at the COP26 summit as well. And recently, she was in the news again for successfully transiting her country of Barbados from to be a fully independent country with Sandra Mason, the first woman to qualify for the bar in Barbados, its new president. I also found out, Sam, this is something which I thought was particularly historic, is that she leads the Barbados Labour Party. And her Labour Party in the 2018 elections won 74% or 73% of the vote in the parliamentary elections. And every seat, 30 out of 30 in the House of Assembly. I thought that was a phenomenal achievement as well. It did help also, Sam. She's a graduate of the London School of Economics in trying to formulate my decision as well.
No, I think that is an excellent shout for Rising Star of the Year. And I mean, for a country as small as Barbados is really in terms of population and geographic size, she was on every headline of the BBC the other week because of Barbados's transition to becoming a republic. And I thought her speeches were excellent, and I really enjoyed also her compliments towards Rihanna as well, saying that she was going to continue to shine like a diamond, and I really appreciated that a lot as well. My nomination for Rising Star of the Year is also another world leader who I think has almost by the end of the year gone under the radar in the most positive sense, which is Mario Draghi, who is now the Prime Minister of Italy. Because we began this year talking about the absolute woes of Italian politics. They were struggling to form a government. They were in financial desperation. They were struggling to get EU recovery funds for the pandemic because of their because of the state of their economy and the state of their political scene. And Mario Draghi stepped in as a technocratic candidate for Prime Minister, and since then has not only managed to get Italy well on the road to stabilisation, not fully stabilised, but has got them well on the road to it, has managed to almost unite warring political parties, at least in agreement that he is probably the best candidate for Prime Minister at this time, and potentially is looking ahead to 2022 as the favourite to become Italy's next president after Mattarella resigns before the presidential election. It's not guaranteed that Mario Draghi will actually step across to the presidential election, but I think it's almost certain that if he does, he will win it, and quite comfortably, because he's earned respect from across the political scene in Italy. And considering where Italy's politics were at the start of this year, I also thought his contribution to COP26 was particularly notable as well, because although COP26, as we'll talk about, did not fully fulfill their primary aims, I thought Mario Draghi's initial speech to COP was a real indicator of how far Italy has come this year, because he used his speech to set out the potential for a new global monetary order. It was dubbed Bretton Woods 2.0 in terms of the scale of what he was proposing to do with reorganization of finance to help poorer countries transition to the new the new climate activist world. And considering the financial woes that Italy was going through at the start of the year and is continuing to go through, I thought the fact that an Italian prime minister stood on a global stage declaring such things was a real indication of how comfortable he feels in his position as Italian prime minister as well, and the kind of mission he's been put on as a technocratic candidate. We'll have to see whether his premiership survives long into 2022, because the turnover of Italian prime ministers has been extraordinarily high in the last decade. But I thought, considering the political journey Italy has been on this year, I thought he deserves a nomination for rising star in the political sphere, considering the absence of political office in his career prior to becoming prime minister.
And that's another, I think it's even more surprising to me, is the context of it, where we all thought Giuseppe Conte would be able to get, you know, to put another Houdini out of the hat in a way and form another government. And I certainly remember when the first thing of Mario Draghi was proposed as Italian prime minister, was surprised, actually. And the fact that she's still relatively popular in Italy, you know, her approval ratings between 65 and 70%. For a technocrat who I suspect at the start of the year wasn't thinking about coming into the bear pit, snake pit of Italian politics, for him to still remain there, I think, at the end of the year, does merit, really, and does show that he has some political skills. Now, I'm not going to predict whether how successful he will be. We've been burnt once in that regard. But yes, I do agree that he, given the cards that were dealt, gave him, and the fact he's been able to successfully remain. And I think because of that, he's elevated Italy to a level of respect that it might not necessarily have in the European Union, if not for Mario, not for him becoming prime minister. I don't think that level of respect that Italy has would not be there if not for the fact that he is prime minister now. Certainly the fact that his past credentials, ECB president, you know, and his past, you know, work would, and has given Italy, I suspect, a newfound level of confidence as, you know, some of its northern European neighbours remain ravaged with the effects of COVID-19.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point.
And finally, on to the final, but probably the most important category, which is politician of the year. This goes to who we think, Sam, is the most, the politician we think deserves the most merit, really. So, Sam, if we went back to last year, we nominated Rishi Sunak as the UK Chancellor, or possibly, as it turns out, had a very much less successful 2021. So who are you going to nominate this year, Sam?
This took me a very long time to come up with my nominations for this category. And I settled on the big one being Olaf Scholz, mainly because I think if you'd have told me even this time last year, potentially even this time 6 months ago, that Olaf Scholz would be finishing 2021 as Chancellor of Germany, I'd have probably laughed in your face, because this SPD's fortunes were so unbelievably low at the start of this year that I thought the prospect of this SPD leading a German government was for the birds. If it was going to be an opposition, it was probably going to be the Green Party, if anything, but even that felt like it was extremely unlikely. So this has mainly gone to Olaf Scholz because of his ability to turn round the SPD's political fortunes, at least in the short term, to win the chancellery. Because we didn't mention it when we were talking about most consequential elections of the year, but really the German one has to be up there as well, because a centre-left government leading Germany for the first time in 16 years is extremely important for the European Union and for Germany as a country, and also for the world going into this new age where climate change is probably going to be at the fore of politics, at least for the short term. So I think Olaf Scholz's Olaf Scholz as Chancellor will be a very different style to Angela Merkel prior to him. And I guess the main reason I've nominated him for this category is because of the turnaround he managed to lead in the SPD. A lot of that is credited to the fact that the CDU had an appalling election. But still, it required some political skill and artistry to manage to at least maintain or even improve the SPD's performance whilst the revolt against the centre in German politics was becoming really problematic for the CDU.
And not only that, I think it did require some political skill to get in front of the Greens, who very much at the start there was seen as the preferred centre-left option. So that definitely does, you know, very much rely on him. But again, you know, you could argue, was that mainly due to Annalena Baerbock's missteps on the campaign? You recall that she had questions over her, you know, academic qualifications, you know, as part of the whole process. And, you know, Olaf Scholz, as portraying himself as a safe pair of hands, sort of, but, you know, he had to cultivate that reputation over the last couple of years. I think you're right, Sam, and I would, and to enhance his winning, and I do think he's a very noble contender for this award, is the fact he has put together a three-party government as well. Never been done before in German politics, and containing the FDP as well, because the FDP has not governed with the SPD since before 1982. And in fact, it was the FDP, if you recall, switching support away from the SPD, which caused the rise of Helmut Kohl in 1982. And they remained loyal as a preferred partner of the CDU all the way until what we will assume will happen next week, which is the swearing in of Olaf Scholz as Chancellor.
And the FDP, and the FDP and SPD manifesto pledges on fiscal policy were basically at polar opposite ends of the spectrum going into this election as well.
Exactly. And even more surprising to that is the fact that we are talking about a new German government before Christmas. Olaf Scholz said that he was going to do that. I suddenly remember being very skeptical of that timeline. And the fact that he's done it, I think, it is also one of the biggest surprises of 2021. Certainly, we are sitting here at this stage, Sam, on, you know, Saturday morning in the UK, 4th of December. You know, we are talking about a potential new German government coming next week. And where's the Netherlands? Oh, wait, they still haven't formed a government yet. And that election took place in March.
Yeah, the opposite political fortunes of Mark Rutte and Olaf Scholz this year have certainly been startling to us and a big surprise.
And that's it for 2021. Well, we'll see how these contenders stack up against the test of time. But some of these, like Olaf Scholz, will definitely do mention. I think, Sam, before we end this discussion, we cannot give an honorary mention to not necessarily a politician, but someone who we definitely, both of us, I'm sure, is a contender for Person of the Year, which is Eugene Goodman, who is the US Capitol Police on that insurrection on January the 6th, who defended the Capitol, who diverted those angry mob protesters away from sitting US senators and congressmen. You know, this was a fundamental attack on US democracy and US democratic institutions. And he and all those Capitol Police deserve a mention as protecting what is fundamentally a tenet of, you know, basic lives in so many countries that delivered us so many freedoms. And it's still an event that scars very much of 2021. And its key role in protecting that does certainly deserve a big honorable mention of this year.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About and our political review of 2021. We thought in this second half, we would turn our attention to some of the themes that have dominated 2021 and have been recurring in our discussions of various elections around the world. But we thought it'd be a nice way to wrap up 2021 by talking about these themes in general. Chern, I thought a good place to start, where else could we start than the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic? Because I think we thought when we were talking about the political year that was 2020 last year, that at least by the end of 2021, the world might have moved on from the pandemic dominating elections. But I don't think that we could have been more wrong, because since the last time we talked about COVID-19 in general, we've had more infectious strands becoming prevalent, not least the Delta variant earlier in the year, and more recently, the Omicron variant that originated in South Africa and is continuing to spread around the world right now. And there's been an absolute seesaw in freedoms, particularly across the Western world, with many like us here in the United Kingdom enjoying quite an unrestricted time in the summer and also now moving into the winter, really, as well. And many other in Europe facing potentially the prospect of another winter lockdown. So, Chern, with all this in mind, I guess a good question to begin with is the impact of COVID on politics. Did it evolve throughout the year, or was it just a constant thing behind the scenes?
I think throughout the year, we've seen the economic impacts of COVID potentially causing a lot of governments to stumble. So if you recall, some of the economic consequences of COVID is supply chain blockages, if you recall. And now we're seeing as ports shut down, particularly in China and all around the world, due to various things, we're seeing increases in inflation as a result. And that is impacting, I think, the politics of many countries. And what we've seen is that in a prolonged period of where things haven't returned to normal, that that these are beginning to bite, particularly as people's incomes have become depressed over the last year. Many have lost jobs, and some of them have not necessarily returned in many, particularly in the developing world as well. And I think a lot of the rhetoric to get people in the start of the year, certainly if I recall the UK rhetoric here in Singapore, was the fact that if you get vaccinated twice, you know, you will get your freedoms back. But it's looking very much the case, particularly as Europe goes back into lockdown, that that was not very much the case. And I think people were willing to tolerate it in 2020, certainly the fear factor of COVID, or certainly the fact that it was the novelty factor of COVID certainly was present during that period. But that novelty period has certainly gone this time around. And as people's frustrations with having to stay very much in their homes, having to curtail their social life, once again, for as we know, it wasn't a 2 weeks, it's going to be potentially over a longer period of time. I certainly has increased people's frustrations towards the government that I think wasn't present at the start of 2021.
I think we definitely see that in approval ratings as well, because I went back to look at our notes from the last time we talked about COVID at the beginning of at the end of January this year, and the approval ratings of the various political leaders we talked about have continued to decline, which adds more evidence to your theory that just people's faith in governments, in terms of giving them the benefit of the doubt over COVID, has certainly dropped. Just a few examples. I mean, Angela Merkel, who is by far one of the most popular leaders, particularly in Europe, has dropped 10 points from a positive 22 to positive 13. Scott Morrison, who was almost the revelation throughout COVID, went from a positive 32 all the way down to negative 2. So that's a drop in 34 points. And Justin Trudeau, positive 9 to negative 9. Even Narendra Modi has gone from positive 59 to positive 45. So everyone's seen a bit of a drop-off in their approval ratings, which just adds more evidence to the fact that the benefit of the doubt to leaders over COVID has begun to evaporate.
Actually, to be honest, you know, Narendra Modi's drop of only plus 59 to plus 45, I think in retrospect can be seen as still quite a really good achievement, actually. If you think about certainly that when Delta wave hit India in a way that it hasn't, the Omicron variant hasn't hit any African country so far as of recording, you know, I think it does mention his political resilience in a way that I think should not be underestimated, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to still, even in any political context, to have an approval rating as high as that is quite a startling achievement, but particularly given the fact that, as you said, India was completely crippled by the Delta variant earlier this year in a very harrowing scenes that everyone was talking about all over the world. Absolutely, I think that's a great point.
Yeah, and the thing as well is that you're beginning to see that impact electorally as well. You know, Trudeau, yes, was gone into negative rating, but Scott Morrison's re-election, if you told me at the start of this year that Scott Morrison will be facing the fight of his election lies, very likely to be caught in May 2022, I would be very much surprised, actually. I think his falling approval ratings, and as we know, you know, judgments of the leaders becoming increasingly important, certainly during COVID, but before that, as the presidential nature of many parliamentary systems placed increasing importance on the prime minister and his approval ratings, I think it was a factor in him delaying the election, potentially looking at one towards the end of the year. And I remember, Sam, telling you, as someone as a close observer of Australian politics, that one of the things at the start that we could prepare for is Scott Morrison deciding to go to the polls at the end of this year. Well, he suddenly, the window for calling an Australian election suddenly passed this year. We're looking at start of 2022 as doing that. And the fact that he's trying to go as far as possible to when his term expires, which is May 2022, suggests he's facing some political problems as well. If we look at another country in that nearby region, Sam, you know, New Zealand and Jacinda Ardern, you know, in 2020, she became one of the few world leaders to win a majority in a proportional representation system under MMP, which is one of the hardest, as we know, political system to win a majority, thanks to the corrective nature of the PR system. But she's falling approval ratings at the moment. Her Labour Party, for example, has fallen over 10 points in the opinion polls. It's only due to the weaknesses of her opposition, really, which is the National Party, which has again over the last week changed its leader after ousting Judith Collins in a vote no confidence, has kept the Labour Party as probably in pole position for at this stage. But certainly the aura of Jacinda, which was very much evident in 2020, is certainly disappeared over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, and I think that's feeds into a bigger point about COVID throughout the year, because I think the one thing we have noticed, and we've talked about this countless times, is that what defined the first half of this year and the latter half of 2020 was the fact that it was very rare that incumbents were defeated because of the COVID boost they'd been having. Whereas in the second half of the year, Justin Trudeau is one of the few incumbents who actually won his respective national election. We saw a change of government in Germany, a change of political affiliation in Iceland, despite the fact that Katrin Jakobsdottir hung on, change of government in Norway, also in September, change of government in Moldova, which you talked about as one of the big turning points this year. And then even more recently, within some of the US special elections in 2021, they both changed hands. And we've just seen
Bulgaria.
Yeah, Bulgaria, in fact, exactly. The Czech Republic, as another example, I could go on. Japan is one of the other few ones where the incumbent government held on, but there's historical precedence for that. So I think just the changing impact of the pandemic has meant that incumbents are no longer given that free pass in an election, and the expectations of them to deliver both on health and economic outcomes are much higher than they were this time last year. And for that reason, a lot of incumbents have fallen short of public expectations in the pandemic. And I think that's just going to get worse as we move into 2022, where people are expecting their countries to be able to move on from COVID. And if they see restrictions still being imposed in a world where large percentages of particularly Western countries have been vaccinated, Western European countries have been vaccinated, then really I think the revolt against the governments are just going to get worse and worse until freedom is restored completely.
And if you recall, Sam, I think one of the big things, apart from economic pains becoming so obvious, was remember at the start of the year, we talked about how much of your population has been vaccinated as a good potential boost to a government. We certainly saw that in the UK, where despite Boris Johnson's quite dire approval ratings, the Conservatives had a phenomenal local election results, if you recall. You know, they did very well in England. They held their own in Scotland, which I certainly didn't expect them to. And in Wales, they made progress on that front, albeit much more limited thanks to Mark Drakeford. So I think as well that the idea of vaccines as a political barometer to judge the governments, where previously it was cases, we now had vaccines, I think that has completely melted away as 2021 has evolved. And as that issue or that number has been paid less and less attention, as people realize that vaccines, it's just using vaccines as a barometer of their freedoms is potentially less of a barometer of regaining their freedoms, mm-hmm. I think that has impacted mm-hmm. politics as well over the last 6 months.
Absolutely. And I mean, a good final question really for COVID-19, Chern, is if we look ahead to 2022, do we expect going into next year that COVID is going to be a big issue at the ballot box again? And in terms of one of its big impacts in suppressing turnout in the past year, do we expect that to still be a problem in 2022 as well?
Yeah, I think that's just very interesting. I'm not sure about you, Sarah. I'd love to hear your thoughts after I tell you mine. Is that I can't see COVID, particularly the start of next year, going away, particularly as we know we're leading to Christmas. The Omicron variant is going to be the big news of it. And I think that is driving the decisions of many governments to, you know, impose many border restrictions from these Southern African countries. And, you know, much of Europe has gone back into lockdown again. So I just can't see COVID not being an election issue, particularly over the last 6 months. But potentially, you know, when we first had these waves or more in the first wave, but potentially less or Delta, the more focus on the economic and social ills of the country very much coming to the fore. You know, the idea of riots in some of these European countries will very much be potentially more in the news than we saw potentially in the first two waves than we will see over the next couple of months. And that would be much more dangerous for any incumbent government. The fact that they not only have, they know they have to protect the citizens and do the right thing by closing the country off, but the act of doing so and imposing restrictions could tear apart the country internally, I think will be one of the big talking points of 2022. And that will be very much due to the fact that COVID-19 is still around. And that will be a negative on the other governments. The big unknown in terms of the actual process of elections, and you talk about the fact that COVID has impacted elections and turnout, and I do think we have some evidence of that. But I think more fundamentally, moving forward, it's changed the way people have voted. Maybe there will be less of these queues that we often see in elections or people queuing outside to vote as well. One of the things many countries have done is to expand the ways in which you can have mail-in voting, postal voting, all these alternatives to queuing up in a ballot box. You and I, if you recall, Sam, queued up in a freezing cold December, if you recall, to vote in the UK general election of 2019. I think there'll be less of those scenes and more people going to their mailbox and putting in their ballots to be counted in the election. I think we will see more of that, and that could be irreversible, and that could be due to COVID-19. And consequently, as a result, Sam, we could expect longer election results because it would take longer for all the mails to come in rather than to count everyone's votes on election night. And that could be irreversible moving forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you just said. And to add on to what you said at the beginning about the progressing impact of the pandemic, I think what you said about the reimposing of restrictions is definitely true. And I think in addition to that, we might continue to be talking about it because of the decisions that need to be made economically as well. Because we thought that the back end of 2021 might be the time when governments are starting to make quite difficult economic decisions to cope with the aftermath of the pandemic. But I think those difficult decisions have almost been shunted into 2022 on the whole. And they probably will have to happen in 2022 if they haven't happened sooner in certain countries, where you might see tax hikes to plug gaps in funding because of the amount of money that's been spent in the pandemic, reimposition of austerity. We're still yet to see a significant financial recession because of COVID, which everybody was expecting, and potentially that might arrive in 2022, who knows? And it's all these lingering impacts of COVID that people might not credit as COVID in terms of a big issue at the ballot box, but are certainly there because of the pandemic. And I think governments will be using the pandemic as the reason for that, because they will need something to explain why they're having to make these difficult decisions to the public. And I certainly think that even if we move on from the devastating news of COVID in terms of the amount of people dying or the amount of people becoming seriously ill, we will still be talking about it because of the financial consequences of the decisions that needed to be made in 2020 and 2021. Not least just using the UK as an example, the furlough scheme was one of the most expensive schemes in British history in terms of the amount of money that the Treasury poured into it. That shortfall needs to be made up somehow. And I don't really think that the decisions have been made yet in terms of what the public have seen from the budget as to how that money is going to be remade. And at some point, those decisions will need to be made, and I would expect it to be sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's going to be a big thing, I think. I'm not sure whether austerity as a policy solution potentially would be very attractive, considering I think one of the enduring things is the power of governments, really. And I think the debate on austerity, potentially, and some of the social problems that come out of it, you know, in an era where COVID-19 economic problems still persist, to compound the austerity on top of that, I think will be a potentially disastrous policy cocktail. But we will see how countries react. I think also the other thing to potentially consider is the fact that many governments, because of the fact that they're only thinking for the next election rather than the next generation, they know that to win the next election, they have to keep spending levels relatively elevated or relatively normal and not cut back spending rather in order to win the next election, because they very much massively discount the future. And I think that that cannot be underestimated in trying to work out what to do with the level of debt in many countries, which has risen exponentially across the world. Another potentially pitfall we need to talk about, and I think this is a good point to end our COVID discussion on, is what's happening right now. And this could be potentially a big consequence of the failure of the vaccine, of one of the big issues of COVID-19, which is vaccine nationalism. We've seen the emergence of the Omicron variant in South Africa, which has relatively lower rates of vaccination compared to other countries around the world. And certainly compared, you know, Africa as a whole region has many countries which have not even vaccinated 10% of this population with its first dose. So Sam, do you think, or do you agree with me, that potentially the failure to vaccinate more people in Africa, even the first dose, when other countries now are talking about, certainly here in Singapore, we were implementing booster shots when Omicron was first discovered, is a policy failure of 2020? And why do you think that happened?
Oh, I absolutely think that will be looked to be one of the biggest failures of 2021 on a global scale. I mean, you talk about Singapore talking about giving booster shots. Well, the UK is just about to give a booster shot to everybody over the age of 18 by the end of January, which when we're talking about these new variants appearing in countries where vaccination levels are low for a first dose, then we're just leaving the breeding ground open for more of these variants to emerge. And we've been lucky so far. Well, we don't know everything about Omicron, but we're expecting its vaccine resistance to be slightly lower than the previous variants. But there could potentially come a day when a variant emerges that is completely vaccine resistant. And that is almost certainly likely to be down to the fact that it has appeared in a region where vaccination rates are incredibly low. And I hope that we don't come to that. I hope that this doesn't happen. And I hope that as we move into 2022, there is a concerted effort to provide sufficient vaccine doses to the world's population. But I do worry that we might look back at 2021 next year as being as that being one of the greatest tragedies of the year, is that failing to take the opportunity to ensure that the world's population is as fully protected as it can be.
I think on the slightly wider theme as well, we're seeing the rise of the sovereign nation state over supernaturalism, globalism. Because if you go back to the start of the 21st century, you're often talking about a global and, you know, supernatural regional bodies, that kind of level of talk. I think the last year has suddenly shown that the idea of a sovereign nation state is very much still an important discussion, and it's still very much important in this as we continue to head into the 2020s as such, than the idea was necessary at the start of the 21st century. So I think that could explain why vaccine nationalism has become such a big, and the consequent policy failures has become such a big issue. But I think that overriding theme is something which has bound a lot of these issues together.
So we'll be coming back to talk to you around Christmas time about one of the other big themes of 2021, which has been climate change. But Chern, as a very final question, because we are fast running out of time, what elections are you looking forward to next year and why?
Well, we had a little discussion about this, and I don't think both of us agree that consequentially, the two big ones to watch out for are the French presidential election, because apart from Germany, France is the big powerhouse of Europe. And in Brazil, which is the largest economy in South America, Jair Bolsonaro is up for his second term. It'll be really interesting to find out whether the pink wave, which is potentially starting to rebuild following recent Honduras presidential elections of Xiomara Castro, the potential left-wing election of Pedro Castillo, Chile, in a couple of weeks' time, where we couldn't again have egg on our faces, you know, whether Brazil will cap off a somewhat triumphant return for the left. And I think that would be very interesting to watch. In France, Emmanuel Macron as well. We can't really look beyond those two countries as well. But on a personal level, I'm very interested in Australian elections. We've seen a complete transformation as we heralded of Scott Morrison's approval ratings to completely collapse over the year. And they were poised for a fascinating election in May. So in May, looks like May. So I'm personally looking forward to that. What are your personal highlights?
I echo all of that, but I will just add to it by saying I think Northern Ireland is a big one to watch out for in May, because we're potentially heading for a historic election in which Sinn Féin actually top the polls. So therefore, in theory, should be getting the office of First Minister. But I think that's definitely going to be a very turbulent election and is certainly one to keep an eye on. But I'll also throw into the mix the Swedish general election as well, because we talked about Magdalena Andersson's rocky road to accepting the premiership. And we'll be looking ahead to whether she actually is even in place to lead her party into that election next year, and what the impact will be on the coalition that's formed afterwards as to whether her premiership comes to an untimely end at the ballot box as well.
And just a final point, it's assuming her government can last October, which, as we've seen from the world of Swedish politics, might not be a given, aren't we?
Exactly. And that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next week when we'll be looking at the formation of Germany's next government and bringing everyone up to speed on some European political events that have been happening in the last month or so, as well as continuing to bring you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the globe. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook @ballot_talk. And please do leave us a rating or review, or simply tell your friends about us. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.